Hello, friends, and welcome to the second hour of Out of This World Radio, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW here on 1150 AM in beautiful Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place, and I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make the Earth a better place. During the first hour, from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I interviewed a wonderful, incredibly interesting gentleman named Tony Rodriguez, who was in the Secret Space Program. And during the second hour, from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., I'll be interviewing another wonderful gentleman named Dr. Michael Sala of exopolitics.org. Dr. Sala is on the Big Island of Hawaii, and in my opinion, he's one of the world's greatest UFO researchers, and he has such incredible information. I'll tell a little bit about his background. He's written a series of books, including in 2009, Exposing U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life, another book in 2013 called Galactic Diplomacy, Getting to Yes with Extraterrestrials. He also wrote a book in 2013 called Kennedy's Last Stand, Eisenhower UFOs, MJ-12, and JFK's Assassination. He's also a recognized scholar in international politics, conflict resolution, and U.S. foreign policy, and he's author-editor of additional four books, including The Hero's Journey Toward a Second American Century in 2002, Essays on Peace in 1995, another book called Why the Cold World Ended in 1995, another book in 1993 called Islamic Radicalism, Muslim Nations, and the West. He previously taught at the Department of Political Science at the Australian National University in Canberra, Australia, and the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, Washington, D.C. in 2002. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia, an MA in philosophy from the University of Melbourne in Australia, and he's conducted research and fieldwork in ethnic conflicts in East Timor, Kosovo, Macedonia, and Sri Lanka, and organized peacemaking initiatives involving high to mid-level participants in these conflicts. And with that, I wanted to see if we were able to get Michael, Dr. Sala, are you there? Can you hear us okay? Can you hear us okay, Dr. Sala?
I can, yes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on today. It's really an honor to have you on.
Oh, thank you, Ted. I'm very pleased to be here.
Of all the people in the world, I consider you the foremost researcher on UFOs and extraterrestrials, and I'm so happy to have you on today, Michael, to share your wisdom with my many listeners around the world.
Glad to help. There's a lot of information, and I'll definitely do my best to make it as clear as possible for people.
Well, you've written so many interesting books, and I've read your articles. His website is www.exopolitics.org, I believe. And you could spend hours listening to reading his articles, listening to his interviews of people like Tony Rodriguez, who I just interviewed here an hour ago. I have to ask you, how did you get interested in UFOs, Dr. Sala, and life beyond this planet?
I heard the Disclosure Project press conference by Stephen Greer in 2001, and that really just changed my research focus. Prior to that, I had been focusing on international politics, and in the description, you read one of the books that I wrote back in 1993 on Islamic radicalism. Well, that was 23 years ago, and now people are talking about Islamic radicalism. So I was kind of like ahead of the curve on that one, and I think maybe this will be the kind of same thing with the exopolitics field, because I began writing on that field in 2003, now it's starting to kind of come into vogue. And certainly I think my interest in international politics and the implications of extraterrestrial life, those are a natural fit, and I'm very happy to be able to kind of like make sense of how this whole extraterrestrial phenomenon influences life at a global level.
You've written some fascinating articles on extraterrestrials and UFOs on your website, and again, I urge everyone to, I hope we don't crash your website, but I urge everyone out there to please check out, to please look up Dr. Sala's website. And one of the fascinating articles that you wrote was, there's almost like a hidden history of what happened after World War II with extraterrestrial contact with the U.S. government, among other governments, that there was Would you mind? I know there's a lot to tell, but I wanted to leave the door open to maybe you could give a little historical background, just a brief one on what happened back then, and lead into the current day topics.
Right. Well, essentially, in the 1930s, the way in which the U.S. government would get its information would be through the military intelligence community. The Navy and the Army had their own espionage services, and the FBI also had its own intelligence service, and that was the way in which they learned about what was going on in the world. And what happened was that the Navy had a program in Nazi Germany, and basically what the Navy spies were hearing was that the Nazis had forged agreements with a group of extraterrestrials called the Reptilians, and that with the help of the Reptilians, they were building these advanced flying saucers that had anti-gravity propulsion systems. So when the Navy spies were reporting this up the food chain, people were incredulous. They couldn't believe this was going on. But there were 29 of these spies embedded throughout Nazi Germany in the different corporations. And, the kind of information that was coming through was pretty consistent. And so eventually what happened was that the Navy realized that this was very real, that, not only were extraterrestrials here, not only were extraterrestrials real, but they had basically intervened in earthly politics and had aligned themselves with one of the sides in a global war. So, you can imagine the implications of that. And the Navy, along with the political hierarchy, basically set in process a program by which the U.S. Presidential administrations, each of them would kind of try and deal with this phenomenon, try and develop their own technologies, their own flying saucer programs, and kind of deal with the different extraterrestrial groups that were intervening in human affairs. That wasn't just a matter of reptilians striking deals with Nazi Germany. There were also a human-looking group of extraterrestrials that were also trying to help behind the scenes, but help in a more kind of spiritual, ethical mode. So you had competing groups of extraterrestrials. You had the world kind of like that in the midst of a global war. So it was pretty complex. And everyone, the different military intelligence services, the different presidential administrations, and different national governments were all trying to make sense of this and try and plot a strategy for the future.
That's incredible. And after World War II, I remember looking at one of your books, Dr. Sala, and you had a picture of these UFOs flying above the Washington, D.C. Capitol Dome back in 1952. Could you explain a little bit about that and what significance that has?
Well, that was a very important incident. It was sighted by thousands of people. It's one of the most documented UFO sightings in history. And what you had was essentially a half a dozen or so flying saucers flying in formation over the capital of the United States. They didn't fire anything. And the thing was that aircraft jets that were sent up to intercept these flying saucers, you couldn't catch up. They couldn't bring them down. This was really a show of force by whoever it was that was flying those saucer craft. And what we have from the testimony of Corey Good and a few other whistleblowers, including William Tompkins and also Clark McClelland, who's another person very familiar with secret space programs, they all said the same thing, that these flying saucers were basically manned by Nazis. That Nazi Germany had succeeded in developing its flying saucer technology out of secret bases in Antarctica in the late 40s and early 50s, to the extent that by 1952 they were able to safely overfly over U.S. airspace over the capital of the United States, the most protected airspace in the country, without any problem, because their technologies were so much more advanced than the Americans. And this was a show of force. It was kind of like the Germans showing the Truman administration, because it occurred in July of 1952, which was kind of like the last year of the Truman administration, it showed the Truman administration that if the president didn't agree to reaching agreement with the Nazis, that there would be very powerful consequences for the U.S. And so this was a catalyzing event, because essentially what happened soon afterwards with the Eisenhower administration coming in was that there were high-level meetings that happened in 1954, 1955. Agreements were reached, and as a result, the Germans were able to infiltrate all aspects of the U.S. military-industrial complex, and thereby were able to kind of like get as much as they wanted in terms of resources, scientific know-how, people, personnel that they needed for their space program to be expanded tenfold from what it was prior to the agreement with the U.S.
That is just an amazing history, and I'm so grateful that you could share that with my many listeners around the world today, Dr. Sala. Let's bring us up. I know there's been a lot of things under the water under the bridge since that time, and I know you've written about the what's called, or Corey Good also has talked about the ICC, the Interplanetary Corporate Conglomerate. How does that work in relation to this to what happened back in the 50s and 60s?
Right. Well, that was the kind of outgrowth of these agreements that were reached between the breakaway Nazi German group in Antarctica with the Truman and Eisenhower administration. Of course, the United States had brought over at least 1,500 prominent German scientists under Operation Paperclip. There were probably many more than the 1,500 that was officially acknowledged. I've heard figures as high as 5,000 of these German scientists were brought in, and many of them were basically fifth columnists. I mean, they were people that worked with the Nazi breakaway group in Antarctica, and they enabled this breakaway group to exert its influence throughout the military-industrial complex, so that as the years progressed, this group in Nazi the breakaway Nazi group was able to get control of many major U.S. aerospace companies, and essentially what that meant was that these companies would have covert programs that would create the technologies that would be used for these deep space classified programs that the Nazis were conducting on the moon, on Mars, and in deep space. And these covert programs were basically under the control of the Nazis or of this breakaway group. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, people know that Lockheed Martin has a think tank called Skunk Works. Well, you know, there's another that deals with kind of a building advanced technologies. There's another even more secretive unit within Skunk Works that's called the Cube, and that particular think tank would be under the direct control of this kind of Nazi corporate alliance with the U.S. Corporate military-industrial complex, and all of that is what came together to form the Interplanetary Corporate Conglomerate. So essentially, you know, what that means is that you have a fusion between the U.S. military-industrial complex and the breakaway Nazi Germany group in Antarctica.
My goodness, this is so interesting, Michael. This is incredibly interesting. Now, I know you've interviewed William Tompkins, a very interesting a man who you've talked to. What has he said about the development of the secret space program from a military standpoint?
Well, he was part of the initial covert intelligence operation that was set up to find out what the Nazis were doing. Mm-hmm. So he participated in the debriefings of 29 Navy spies that were in Germany, and his job was to listen to the debriefings and put together briefing packets of what the spies had revealed that could then be taken to various think tanks, aerospace companies, university departments, anyone in the US who was capable of understanding the technologies that the Nazis were developing, so that the US would be able to kind of like better understand what the policy implications was, and also start to develop a response to that. And that led to the creation of the RAND Project. By 1945, the RAND Project actually emerged, and that was it began as a covert group involving top Navy admirals, Army Air Force generals, and leading engineers from the Douglas Aircraft Company. Mm-hmm. And by 1945, it formed a group that was headquartered in Santa Monica, and their job was to really understand what was feasible in terms of developing technologies, given the understanding of extraterrestrials being present on the Earth. And so Tompkins was very much a part of that. He was at the beginning of the setting up of that think tank, and later on in 1950. He began to work for the Douglas Aircraft Company, and they continued to have a think tank that was dedicated to understanding the extraterrestrial phenomenon and put together technologies that the Navy now would be interested in developing for a Navy secret space program. So William Tompkins, from the years 1950 up until 1963, worked at Douglas Aircraft Company and directly participated in this covert program between the Navy and Douglas Aircraft, where the Navy would receive these unsolicited bids for designing space battle groups, and the Navy would provide funding for these designs to kind of like be pursued, so that eventually the Navy could develop detailed architectural plans and then build them.
Well, I have to. There's so many ways we could go with this, Dr. Sella, but it's so incredibly interesting what you're sharing, and I want to thank you again so much for coming on today. You have in our television interview that we did a couple days ago, you mentioned that you have a new book coming out, and if you don't mind, I want you to share that with everyone so people can get a copy of your book. But you also have a section on Star Trek and Gene Roddenberry, who produced and wrote the Star Trek series. And you have a section on how he got his information. I think this is just fascinating, what you wrote about there.
Right, yes. There is a new book. It's currently being edited, and it should be out in March of 2017. It's called The U.S. Navy's Secret Space Program and Nordic Extraterrestrial Alliance. And so it basically details the testimony of William Tompkins in you know, what I've just described, in his involvement in this Navy program, in setting it up and helping design the spacecraft, and looks at the many documents that Tompkins has supplied, as well as documents I've been able to get through the Freedom of Information Act that corroborate his testimony in key ways. But what was very interesting was that Tompkins pointed out that this Navy program to build space battle groups was actually being helped by a Nordic group of extraterrestrials. So while you had kind of major elements of the U.S. military-industrial complex, especially the U.S. Air Force, working closely with the reptilians and the Nazis that were based out of Antarctica in building their space program, you had another U.S. military service working with the other major extraterrestrial group that had been intervening on the planet, but in a much more covert way, which was the Nordic extraterrestrials. And, you know, people refer to them in many different ways as the Galactic Confederation, whatever name you want to give them. But these were essentially a very benevolent group that believed in developing higher consciousness, in developing spirituality, and that that was important in terms of being able to better understand technologies. And interestingly, the Navy, senior people in the Navy were more receptive to this than the other military service, which was the Air Force. The Air Force were kind of like all gung-ho into getting into the technology. They weren't at all interested in the kind of spiritual stuff. But the Navy were much more open to that. And Tompkins kind of like describes how he was being helped by these Nordics in developing these technologies, and that the Navy kind of like facilitated this. They didn't object to this at all. And one of the people that was involved in this program was Admiral Leslie Stevens. Now, the thing about Admiral Leslie Stevens is that his son, Leslie Stevens Jr., he was the producer of the science fiction series The Outer Limits that aired in, I think it was 1964, 1965.
I remember that.
And one of the people that sat in on the set of The Outer Limits was Gene Roddenberry. And at the time, Gene Roddenberry had just had a kind of failed television series called The Lieutenant. It only ran for one year. It was about a Navy lieutenant. But it didn't succeed. And so Roddenberry was basically directed by his agent to develop a sci-fi series. And so Roddenberry sat in on the Outer Limits episodes and reached an agreement, a covert agreement. And this is something that people that worked on the Outer Limits have confirmed, that Roddenberry and Leslie Stevens Jr. had reached an agreement whereby Stevens would feed Roddenberry a lot of information about sci-fi, about ideas and plots and so forth, and that then Roddenberry would create a new series, and that new series became Star Trek. But the thing is, when you look at Star Trek, it has within it the key elements of the secret space programs and the different extraterrestrial groups that William Tompkins was talking about. You know, the three major protagonists, or some of the major protagonists in the Star Trek series, are almost identical with what the Navy spies were telling the Navy and what Tompkins had learned. You know, for example, you have reptilians. Well, in the Star Trek series, the reptilian pretty much correspond with the Klingon. You have Nordic extraterrestrials. Well, in the series, they pretty much correspond with the Galactic Confederation and groups like the Vulcan. According to the Navy spies, you had the Nazis developing the very first cloning program, where they were basically developing genetically enhanced humans. Well, in the Star Trek series, you had genetically enhanced humans. And that these were also one of the major protagonists. And of course, in the first Star Trek movie, you had the Wrath of Khan. Well, Khan was one of these genetically enhanced humans. Khan represented the Nazi space program that was operating in deep space. So in many, many levels, you have the storylines in Star Trek matched what William Tompkins had been told about the secret space programs that the U.S. Navy had learned about.
My goodness, what an incredible revelation you've given all my listeners. Thank you so much, Dr. Sella. That's just amazing, just amazing. I've often wondered that myself, and now it makes sense. When Tony, our friend Tony, your friend Tony Rodriguez was on my earlier show an hour ago, he mentioned that as a slave, he would wear these things around his neck, and that if he misbehaved or wouldn't follow orders, they would activate it and give him a shock to his system. And there was an old Star Trek episode on that. I think it was on Khan, too, where Khan had the Wrath of Khan, where he had these things around people's necks to make them do what he wanted to. It's fascinating, really. There was a corollary with that.
Well, you know, this is the thing, that that kind of technology was developed in the 40s and 50s by the Nazi breakaway group. You know, one of the things that is very important to point out is that the Nazis were big believers in using slave labor. They used it during the war, and with their breakaway civilization down in Antarctica, they basically used a lot of slave labor, and they just continued to use slave labor in the decades ever since. So this was something that was very much a part of the Nazi ideology. Albert Speer, who was the German armaments minister during the Second World War, he actually described how Nazi Germany were prepared to use slave labor in the post-war period, because the Nazis thought that they would win the war, and once they won the war, you know, the Nazis weren't going to end slave labor; they were going to continue it. So they were fully prepared to continue using slave labor once the war was won. But of course, they lost the war. But nevertheless, in their breakaway civilization that they established in space and out of Antarctica, they used slave labor. And of course, as you mentioned, you know, this appears in the Star Trek series, because the Navy knew all this. So this was stuff that the Navy intelligence service had learned about. And of course, you know, like the Wrath of Khan, that's a great example of how these Nazis operated using those shock collars. And certainly, Tony Rodriguez, I mean, his testimony is just one example, and I'm sure there'll be many more as we have more and more whistleblowers coming forward, more and more witnesses coming forward to reveal this. I mean, you know, this is the leading edge now of information about secret space programs. You know, people like Randy Kramer, Corey Good, right. William Tompkins, right. and now Tony Rodriguez. There's going to be many, many more coming forward.
Well, there's so many ways we could go. We've got about a half hour left, but I want to mention something you told me yesterday in your television interview, and that's that the kinds of generals that Donald Trump has surrounded him around are very interesting because of the different branches of service. Could you comment on that again, please, Dr. Sala?
Sure. Well, it's very interesting that Trump at the moment has nominated three four-star generals or admirals to occupy senior positions. His national security advisor is this Michael Flynn. He's actually a three-star army general. He's also nominated a four-star marine to be the Secretary of Defense. He's nominated a four-star marine to be the head of Homeland Security. He's nominated a four-star admiral to be the to head up the who's going to be his new director of national intelligence. So that's four senior generals that occupy senior positions in his administration. And then you look at his strategist, his Stephen Bannon, who is his chief strategist. He is a former Navy officer. So you have four generals, another Navy officer, who all are at very senior positions in Trump's national security hierarchy. And what that suggests to me is that Trump is surrounding himself with key military people, because he knows that he's going to need them to really change the national security system, to really break open the can of worms when it comes to all of these classified programs that have been kept secret. And I think this is something that Trump was advised on very early on. As I mentioned, Steve Bannon, the chief editor from Breitbart News, has been advising Trump for some time now. And so Trump knows just how deep the rabbit hole goes, and I think he understands the importance of having senior military people around him. But what's interesting is that all of these people come from the Marines, the Navy, or the Army. Not one of them comes from the Air Force, because the Air Force is the U.S. military service which is the most compromised, the one that is most in collusion with these reptilians and greys that have been working closely with the Nazis ever since the 1940s and 50s.
Wow, that's incredible information, and I just want to thank you again. Now, another question I'd love to ask you is you wrote a book about the assassination of President Kennedy, and I know that he had ordered disclosure shortly before he was assassinated back on November 22nd in 1963. What kind of world do you think we would have now if President Kennedy had lived, Michael?
Oh, I think it would have been a dramatically different world. President Kennedy, he understood the depth of this problem. He understood what the result of the agreements between the Nazi breakaway group in Antarctica and the agreements with the Eisenhower administration, what that involved. Eisenhower gave his famous farewell speech in 1961, warning about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. Well, Kennedy knew what Eisenhower really meant. I mean, Eisenhower kind of like gave it a very vague reference as the military-industrial complex, but Kennedy knew what Eisenhower really meant was that, beware of the kind of collusion between the Nazis, the reptilians, and key elements of the U.S. military-industrial complex that had basically formed this kind of military, industrial, extraterrestrial Nazi complex. And this was the danger. And so Kennedy knew that, and he knew that the biggest antidote to this alliance was the truth. And the first step was to kind of like share the information amongst the different branches of the U.S. bureaucracy, like with NASA, and also with major countries like the Soviet Union at the time. And once you shared that information, then the groundwork could be laid for public disclosure. And that was something that Kennedy, I think, would have done. He was going to follow the footsteps of his mentor, who was James Forrestal, the first Secretary of Defense, who was in 1945, while Forrestal was Secretary of the Navy. He took Kennedy to Germany, occupied Germany in July and August of 1945, and showed Kennedy all of the captured Nazi technologies and what the Navy had learned. So Kennedy knew all about the Nazi breakaway group, and he was going to continue to go down a path of kind of like making this information more widely known within the bureaucracy and eventually officially disclose it to the world.
That's incredible. And what kind of energy system do you think we would have today? Do you think we'd be using fossil fuels today if President Kennedy had lived?
Oh, no, not at all. I think that if Kennedy had lived, I think we would have had... we'd have a Star Trek society. I mean, mm-hmm. What you see with Gene Roddenberry,
right.
That is exactly the type of society we would have had if Kennedy had been allowed to move forward. Because the thing is, Kennedy was a Navy guy. He worked with Navy intelligence, and he was very close with the Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal. So Kennedy knew that the Navy was developing a secret space program. He knew what the Navy had in mind. So what the Navy wanted to do was to develop a Star Trek society, because the Navy understood that only by doing this openly could you lay a secure foundation for not only the United States, but also the whole planet, to become a major space power and a member of the galactic community. But it had to be done openly. And the reason for that, Ted, is that if you do it secretly, well, then you had to raise the money for this secretly. And that would mean that you would rely on entities like the CIA to raise the money off the books through illicit activities like the drug trade, like child trafficking, sex trade, manipulation of financial markets, basically creating dirty money that would be laundered through the CIA to fund all of these programs. Well, you know, the Navy at the beginning kind of like accepted that, because that was the way in which you could move forward to fund your secret space program development. But the Navy understood that that was no long-term solution or foundation for the U.S. Becoming a space power. And so they wanted to basically reveal the truth. Kennedy knew this, as did Roddenberry, as he had learned through his Navy contacts. Mm-hmm. And so this was what Kennedy had in mind, something very much along the lines of Star Trek. And that is what would have happened if Kennedy hadn't been assassinated.
What an amazing, amazing comment you just said, Michael. And I think you're absolutely, absolutely right. Briefly, I know we're covering a lot of topics now, but briefly, what happened back in 1947 with Admiral Byrd? If you could explain a little bit about that to my listeners.
Well, people know that in 1946, 1947, Admiral Byrd went to Antarctica under Operation High Jump. What is not known is that in 1945, 1946, Admiral Byrd went to Antarctica on a secret negotiation to meet with the representatives of the breakaway Nazi group in Antarctica to sign an agreement with them, or to forge an agreement with them, because the U.S. Navy and the Truman administration thought, well, the Germans in Nazi Germany had negotiated terms of surrender, and they had reached deals, and so they thought that they would do the same thing with the Nazis in Antarctica. Well, the Nazis in Antarctica, they didn't consider themselves to be a defeated power. They still considered themselves to be at war with the United States, or at least it was a Cold War. So, you know, they basically told Byrd, you know, to get lost, that they weren't going to sign any agreement, that they were not a defeated power, and that if the Navy tried to intervene in Antarctica, that they would be punished. So, well, you know, the Navy didn't kind of take kindly to that, and so the next available opportunity was the summer of 1946-47. Admiral Byrd led the Operation High Jump expedition, and what happened was that, and this is something that William Tompkins and a few others have described, is that Nazi flying saucers flew out of the ocean from their underwater or under ice bases in Antarctica and attacked the Operation High Jump Navy flotilla and, you know, wreaked great damage on it. You know, they shot down most, if not all, of the planes. They destroyed a number of the destroyers. And basically the Navy flotilla was defeated and had to be returned home. And basically they showed the Navy that the Navy's technology was no match for what the Nazis had. So this presented a huge dilemma to the Truman administration, because the Navy couldn't get access to the Nazi Antarctic bases. The British Special Air Service, which was their elite covert operations team, they also were up there in 1946-47. They couldn't get access to it. And the U.S. couldn't use atomic weapons against the Germans, as they did in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, because the problem was that the Nazis were buried, their bases were under 2 miles of ice. So, their bases were very well protected against any kind of nuclear attack. So the Navy had no way of punishing the Germans, and the Germans went ahead and continued to improve their technologies and continue their space program, so that by 1952 they had reached a level of development that was so far ahead of anything that the U.S. had developed that by then the Truman and the Eisenhower administration had to negotiate a treaty on the terms that were favorable to the Nazi breakaway group in Antarctica.
That's amazing. And now it's 64, 65, almost 65 years later, Michael, and my goodness, and now we have, of course, there's all kinds of things going on out there with secret space program, which very few people know about now, but it's the word's getting out, and that's why I'm so happy to have you on today. I have to ask you this, too. I know we could go a lot of different ways on this. What about we talked yesterday on the television about how we were moving toward the law of one, from service to self to service to others here in the on planet Earth. Would you care to talk about that from a spiritual point of view, by the way?
Sure. Well, this is one of the things that Corey Good has emphasized in terms of the information he's been given through the multiple secret space programs and also from the Sphere Being Alliance. Now, the Sphere Being Alliance are a relatively new group of extraterrestrials. I mean, they would be best categorized as a Type 3 civilization. Type 1 civilizations are civilizations that can manipulate energy at a planetary level. Type 2, that can manipulate energy at a stellar level, you know, energy from the sun and so forth. And Type 3 civilizations are civilizations that can manipulate or use energy at a galactic level. So they are the most advanced groups of extraterrestrials to have kind of intervened in not only planetary affairs, but also solar in our solar system for many millennia. And of all of the different extraterrestrial groups, including the Reptilians and the Nordic Alliance, these seem to be Type 1 or Type 2 civilizations. Now, the Type 3 civilization, the Sphere Being Alliance, what they've told Corey Good is that our entire solar system is moving into a region of the galaxy where very soon we're going to be hitting, we've actually begun experiencing heightened cosmic energies, and that's going to trigger large stellar phenomenon, which in turn is going to be a trigger for something that is referred to as an ascension event. Now, exactly what this ascension event entails is that the frequencies, the cosmic frequencies, the stellar frequencies, the electrical frequencies that are pulsing through our bodies are going to be heightened to such an extent that if we don't raise our consciousness sufficiently, we run very real risks of really going kind of mad or just kind of like falling apart if we don't raise our consciousness. And so what the Sphere Being Alliance have recommended is following the law of one information. That's just one set of information that helps prepare one for this ascension event. And in the law of one, it emphasizes this idea of service to other, that you know, there's two kind of major ethical polarities, service to self, where basically you just kind of look after your interest is in yourself or in your immediate community, or service to other, where you have a kind of much more humanitarian outlook, and you're trying to think of how to help others rather than just helping yourself. And according to the Sphere Being Alliance, this is the best way of being able to prepare for this ascension event, because when you consider others as kind of like extensions of yourself,
right?
Then you have a way of being able to integrate these heightened cosmic and stellar energies in a way that then switches on your higher consciousness. And when your higher consciousness is switched on, then you are going to be able to develop abilities and understandings that are far ahead of anything that we know, so that we can deal with any kind of heightened stellar events or cosmic events and this ascension event in a very harmonious and smooth way. So basically, the way Corey Good expresses it, he says, you know, just develop a kind of more profound peace and love message.
I have to tell you, Dr. Sala, this is the most profound, beautiful, and important interview I've ever done on this show. I've been going this now for, I think, well over 3 years, and I just want to thank you so much for sharing those words of wisdom.
Thank you, Ted. That's really touching to hear that. I appreciate that.
And I wasn't going to ask you on air, but I think I will. What are you doing next year on March 10, 11, and 12, 2017? Would you like to come to my conference, All Expenses Paid?
Wow, that's a great invitation, Ted. I'll just have to check my itinerary, but I'll get back to you. But thank you for that invitation. It's very touching.
I would love to have you here. I've heard you speak before at other conferences, and what you have to say is so fascinating. I have to tell you that I've been given information too. There's a huge blast of cosmic energy that came to planet Earth from September 5th through the 15th, a few months ago, again on the 22nd and 23rd of September. And Dr. Sala, guess when the next wave is going to hit?
Please, let me know. I'll be very interested.
5 days from today.
Well, that is very interesting. That's just after the Electoral College vote.
Oh, no. Well, I was told December 16th through the 23rd is going to be a huge wave. I had Simon Parks on my show here a few weeks ago, and he said he agreed with me with the start date, but from his sources, he says it's going to continue into early January, which I think is correct. So for everyone out there, I know that when this huge blast of good cosmic energy came to the planet to raise vibration and raise consciousness here came in September, I was really tired. I was sleeping 12 to 14 hours a day, and I said to myself, is there something wrong with me? And I thought, no, I'm getting this energy. I asked for it. But I want everyone to be prepared for it, because it's just more than the holidays and you know, being tired from being busy. There's going to be another huge blast of beautiful cosmic energy coming to the planet, and just be prepared. If you can, build in some extra sleep time during that time. It's easy to do, but they're doing it right around Christmas, starting the 16th of December, which is only 5 days from today.
Well, I think that's kind of like part of what Corey has been telling us, that that the Sphere Being Alliance have said that these kind of cosmic energies kind of come in like waves. So yes, so it looks like another wave, and the waves keep on building, and each time this wave comes, yes, people are affected in different ways. Like you said, you might need to sleep, but that's just your way. One way of being able to integrate this energy. Mm-hmm. Other ways of just kind of like being out in nature, spending more time in nature. That is a good way of doing it. If you live in rural areas, or actually wherever you live, just spend as much time as you can in nature, because that is a way of kind of like harmonizing your body with these incoming cosmic waves.
A really good way I've been told to do that, Dr. Sala, is to simply take your shoes off, and it's cold out here in Seattle today. I don't think we're above freezing, and people may think I'm crazy to suggest this, but take a walk in like a park if it's warm enough outside, or ground yourself swimming. Up here, I think if you try to swim in this weather, it wouldn't be very good for your health, but try to get out in nature at any rate, because nature, we're all part of Gaia, the Mother Earth, and I think that she will help us certainly replenish our energy. It's called earthing. That's when you walk, for example, in a city park. I have friends down in Florida who I've recommended that to, and it's really helped them. They're busy people, and it really helps them ground. Dr. Sella, we've got about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I wanted to thank you so much for coming on today. I'm interviewing Dr. Michael Sala, who I consider one of the world's best UFO researchers on ETs and life beyond this planet. His website is www.exopolitics.org. And I wanted to ask you if you could tell people about your upcoming presentations in Australia, because I have listeners in Australia as well.
Oh, well, yes, thank you. Yes, I'll be going to Australia in on January 7. I'll be doing a workshop in Melbourne at Victoria University. And on January 15, I'll be doing a workshop in Perth at the State Library there in Perth. And I'll be talking about the latest information about the secret space programs, the upcoming book, and you know, what the prospects are for full disclosure.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I'm sure you know this too, but well, back in 94, I was on a scholarship to Murdoch University in Fremantle, which is a suburb of Perth, Dr. Sella. And in Fremantle, there is a whole string of Italian coffee shops with the most wonderful Italian coffee outside of Italy. So if you're in Perth, be sure to go there and check out their Italian coffee. It's quite good.
We'll do that, Ted. That sounds great.
And all of the – it's funny because they were Australian prisoners of war from World War II, and there's a whole bunch of them who decided not to go back to Italy. They stayed in Australia. And they first had to change the laws about having sidewalk cafes, because the old laws in Australia considered it unhealthy to eat outdoors or have a cup of coffee outdoors. But they got it changed, and now there's a whole string of these wonderful Italian coffee shops with the most wonderful cappuccino outside Italy in Fremantle. It's called Frio, and it's a wonderful little place to go. So if you are there, be sure to try some of that wonderful coffee. We've got about 6 minutes left, and this is one of my favorite topics. Michael, on how people, what can people do to raise consciousness and make this planet a better place? What would you recommend?
Well, I think there's a lot of different information out there on what people can personally do. One of the sources of information that I think is really helpful is the Seth material that was mm-hmm. material that Jane Roberts channeled in the 60s and 70s. And what's interesting is that according to Corey Good, the Seth material is one of the recommended readings for participants in the Secret Space Program. So it's very interesting that the Secret Space Programs direct their people to read this the Seth material, because they're very interested in raising, developing psychic abilities and being able to raise your consciousness so that you can kind of deal with some of these big questions that confront people in the Secret Space Programs, because they are very much into psychic development. But I think mm-hmm. in terms of raising consciousness, I think the what comes through the Seth material and what comes through many other sources is that the more we spend time doing the things that we love doing, mm-hmm. The more our consciousness raises. Mm-hmm. So it really is all about, Joseph Campbell put it beautifully, just follow your bliss. The things that give you joy, those are the things that are most going to raise your consciousness. Now, that sounds easy, Ted, because it is easy, but it's also terrifying because, I was told this, in the year 2000, I learned about this in 2001, that, following my bliss in terms of putting my energy into studying this extraterrestrial phenomenon, I had a great time doing it, but it also raised this tremendous dilemma, because I had a salary position as a university professor, and it became clear that the more energy I put into this area of research, right. that my salary position was being threatened. And eventually what happened was that I had to make a choice. If I was going to continue to research the extraterrestrial phenomenon, that my university career, something that I had spent decades developing and studying, and that was my dream to teach in universities, but that was threatened, and that my livelihood was threatened. And so eventually that's what happened, that I did follow my bliss, but I lost my job and my career in the process. So while it sounds easy, follow your bliss, follow right. the thing that gives you joy in life, there's a tremendous risk, because sometimes it means giving up the things that provide you security, financial stability, even emotional support. It might be a partnership where maybe you're not being fulfilled in some way. So, yes, following your bliss kind of like sounds easy, and it is easy, it's very natural, but on the other hand, it makes us confront the kind of the financial, emotional things that create stability in our lives. So, but I think ultimately that's what we need to do if we want to raise our consciousness.
I have to share this with you, Dr. Sella. Lao Tzu once said, "The hardest part of a 1,000-mile journey is the first step." And I know exactly how you feel, because when I started my radio show in 2013, I felt exactly the same thing. I said to myself, what on earth am I doing starting a radio show? And then earlier this, it's been very successful, and since that time I started my own television show. But for everyone listening out there, follow your bliss. Do try to pay attention to what your heart mind says about the right thing to do. And again, I want to thank you so much for coming on today, Dr. Sella. 1 week from today, we'll be having on Joseph Anthony, a wonderful astrologer with some predictions for the coming year. We will be broadcasting on December 23rd. And following him during that first hour will be the wonderful Dr. Yoshi from Tokyo, Japan, along with his my good friend Michiko Hayashi, will be talking about Hado Machines and the Modal Peace Project. So it'll be a very special Christmas program. And with that, I want to give you the rest of the time. We've got about a minute left, Dr. Sella, and please say anything you'd like.
Well, thank you, Ted, for giving me this opportunity to share this information with people. And what I'd recommend to anyone listening in terms of what they can best do to help change things is to just tell friends, tell people, tell your loved ones. The holiday season's coming up. Buy a gift, buy a book, or buy a DVD about the Secret Space Program, about the information that's been put out. I've got a website, exopolitics.org, where there's a lot of information there. There's products, books, and DVDs that people can order, and just share this information. That's the thing that I think is going to really help.
Wonderful.
To get the word out.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Sella. Everyone, I hope you all have a wonderful Out of This World weekend. Bye-bye.